Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm your host, Ryan Shelton, and today it's my great pleasure to be joined by Monique Ingalls, author of the new book, Singing the Congregation, How Contemporary Worship Music Forms Evangelical Community, published in 2018 by Oxford University Press. Monique is Associate Professor of Music, Church Music Graduate Program Director, and on the Affiliated Faculty of Religion at Baylor University. Monique, thanks for being here, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan. It's great to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, Monique, I'm so excited to get into this book with you. But before we do, I wonder if you might be willing to share with us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So, as you already said, I teach at Baylor. I have the distinct privilege. I'm the graduate student program director. I teach a lot of doctoral courses related to congregational singing. So many of my own ideas about research germinate from ideas in the class. So I consider myself, you know, really fortunate to have teaching and research be so closely connected. But my own background. So I grew up in, I'm an insider to some degree to the community that my book is about, that my book focuses on. I was raised in a self-described fundamentalist, actually, church. So a church on somewhat of the right margins of the phenomenon that I'm studying. And I got interested in music and its role in worship as a very early age. I'm a pianist. I would play for church around junior high. The worship wars, what are called these conflicts over musical style, came to my church. And I watched... You know, I watched and I listened as church leadership and as people, you know, disagreed and talked over what different styles meant. And I was curious. At that point, it was framed as very much an either or, you know, this idea of worship wars as a zero sum game, that it either, you know, could only be traditional or contemporary. And I remember at the time, although I didn't have the words to say it quite this way, like, why can't it be both and? What is it about these, you know, these styles and what they mean that makes people pit them against one another? So that was something that I carried with me through, you know, undergraduate into graduate school. I saw a golden opportunity to be able to research this area, which surprisingly not many people were doing at the time, though I've been so pleased to see in the last 10 or so years just a proliferation of studies on contemporary worship within evangelical and charismatic circles, kind of as liturgy, as well as contemporary worship, the music that comes from that.
That's wonderful, Monique. So much of the data that this book is built upon is original ethnographic field notes. I wonder if you might be willing to tell us a little bit about your research methodology and how you collected your data.
Yeah, absolutely. In designing my study initially, I was there were several point that I was just, I was stumped. I felt like I kept running into a wall because I didn't want to, I knew that worship music was so much broader than the church. It was common to do a church-based case study, or maybe to choose three churches and do a comparative contrastive study in there. But I thought, this music is going on in concerts. That was another venue, was just to study it as popular music. But a lot of those studies that emphasized, radio airplay and the concert scene, how Christian music had become, kind of its own popular culture, had minimal interaction with the church, except just to say that, there's some overlap here. So I thought about, how do I design a study that gets at all of these different dimensions? And my initial study considered concert, conference, and church spaces as kind of as three. And I didn't think of it at that point. So modes of congregating, the way that I go on to describe them, came a little bit later. But that's the way that I tried to get at the phenomenon is, okay, I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, which I figured, this is, at least at the time, was the center of the commercial center for the Christian music industry. It's also the buckle of the Bible Belt, so pretty easy to find churches singing this music. At one point I was attending, there was one Sunday I remember I attended four churches. I was trying to keep my my foot in charismatic Pentecostal, kind of your free church, non-charismatic, like your Baptist, Methodist, and then your mainline liturgical traditions that use contemporary worship. And there was one Sunday that I attended four services, and I thought, this is not productive. I need to focus this down just a bit more than that. And out of that decision came the one church that is a case study focus in my book, rather than the initial three or five, four pronged, church case studies. But I was based through the first part of the research period, I was based in Nashville, and I was attending concerts that came to the area, Christian singers who would come in, and Nashville's a pretty big hub. So we would see, a lot of the major, kind of networks represented, like Bethel and Hillsong, and some of the North American as well as global, globally significant worship leaders and groups came through there. But I also went out to different places that I identified as hubs for the creation of this music. So for instance, the Passion Conference was something that I followed very closely from the beginning. It had been for a few years after starting in Texas, it had been based in Nashville and then moved to Atlanta. So I made the trip, the 4-hour, drive to Atlanta quite a few times, as well as a few other stops in between. So it is, in some ways, the study, it began as a, sort of Nashville, I've got to live somewhere, right? So I lived in Nashville and, and expanded out to these areas. Where the second sort of part of the book came in was in reflecting on that work and thinking of, okay, what does this need to be, a fully orbed book? There are some some dynamics that I had wanted to study that I didn't have a chance to do starting out with church and concert and conference. And so I expanded the earlier work looking at the public space, so looking at the use of worship music in praise marches. These were, I'd say, more common, I would say, in the 90s, at least in the North American setting, but there are still praise marches today there are still praise marches among Protestants, evangelicals in Brazil that draw 2 and 3 million people, kind of the Protestant alternative to carnival. So as far as a global phenomenon, these, even though, those in North America, that they might not be as familiar, I found a kind of stumbled upon while living in Toronto, this Praise March that incorporated all of these different Christian denominations as well as immigrant groups to Canada. So it was really a fascinating space to discover how contemporary worship music was bringing together people, not just across, you know, denomination, but ethnic and national backgrounds as well. And then the final piece, the final component that's in my book is the networked, or, you know, worship online, realizing that since the advent of YouTube and the fact that, you know, people freely share these videos, you know, on their social media and, you know, with each other, that had become not just a way of sharing worship, but actually could be looked at as a site itself for around which people congregated. So that was what spurred kind of the final piece of my book, is realizing that, okay, this music is, of course, disseminated online, but you know, the internet, either whether you're talking about the individual video that people are saying, you know, that I'm praying as I'm watching this video on YouTube, you know, I have a worship time every morning, you know, where I watch these videos, or where, you know, online and offline become interconnected, where churches, you know, I talk about one of these in the book, that small churches who want to do this style of music and don't have the personnel, or at least don't feel like they can, you know, get the musical quality up to par, actually, you know, use YouTube videos and sing along with them on a Sunday morning. So kind of, you know, I mean, church karaoke, that's, I don't mean to be, you know, to be dismissive of the practice, but Vivo Church, you know, using these official videos and, you know, and singing along with them. It's a way that what was produced and shared online has taken on a new life offline.
That's wonderful, Monique. So we'll get into some of these different modes of congregating in just a second, but it seems that one of the key arguments of your book is that as evangelicals have largely embraced mass media culture into their public worship gatherings, this hasn't only changed the sound of their music making,
yeah,
but actually their social structures and religious identity. Is that right? Is that the argument that you're trying to promote throughout your book?
Absolutely. Yes. The, you know, a couple of questions, a couple of kind of large scale questions that I've had in, you know, in my mind, and I know that, you know, other researchers have addressed through other means, you know, this, you know, a couple of them, you know, one related to evangelicals and the other related to, you know, kind of Christian modes of congregating. You know, one question, who are evangelicals anyway? This question, this definitional question that I spend many pages of the introduction of this book trying to come to terms with, because the term who identifies as an evangelical is fluid, you know, changes over time. It changed actually quite a bit as the result of the 2016 elections. So kind of wrestling with that, you know, people who would have called themselves evangelicals, you know, before the, you know, the rise of Donald Trump and Trumpism, who are now no longer considering themselves to be in the fold. Anyway, the evangelical definition is complicated, and people have tried over the years to nail down evangelicals on, you know, they believe these four things, or they use these particular practices. And, you know, so one of my thoughts, and of course, you know, the thought that would, of course, come from, you know, from a musicologist is, what about a musical definition of evangelicals? What if evangelicals are the people who, by and large, sing this music? What does that mean? What would studying this music tell us about this group of people called evangelicals? And somewhat related to that, although, you know, not related to the specific group, another question, what is a congregation in the 21st century? So as you mentioned, you know, our media and communications technologies have revolutionized the way that we interact with each other. And I just started to see in my work and through what I described a minute ago with the networked congregations, is that the way that people experience themselves together how people do congregate for worship rather than how, you know, perhaps they feel like they should, or how leaders are telling them that they, you know, that they should congregate for worship, that that wasn't something being being explored, at least in my own scholarly circles, in any detail. So in some ways, taking an empirical, for lack of a better term, an experiential take, trusting and trying to understand people's experience of gathering. I know that there's a congregation. I use that to describe people who have gathered or assembled for the purpose of worship, and it doesn't imply a set structure or even a consistent group of people who are worshiping together. You know, a lot of the people that I spoke with see themselves as members of multiple worship gatherings. And, you know, they might worship weekly at a church, and during the semester, you know, at a college group or a Bible study. Every year they go to a particular conference and they keep up relationships with people, with people there. They, have groups that they're part of through social media. They keep up with worship music through recordings. So all of those ways, people are gathering for worship in all of these discrete ways that, you know, yes, they intersect, they overlap, but sometimes they come into some interesting, conflict and competition as well.
So fascinating. Tempted to dive into that further, but I'm going to move on for now. I wonder if you could tell us about the concert congregation. What's unique about this particular mode of gathering for Christian worship, and what are the consequences, good or bad, of reframing a rock concert into a worship experience?
Yeah. A great question. And I think in some ways so the book starts with the concert congregation chapter. That was it was a deliberate decision. And I think the concert chapter is an excellent entry point into the others, because it just takes, it presents you first off with the change that has happened since worship became a highly valuable commodity. And this is something I've done in previous work that's referenced in this chapter. Have done some work on when worship music was taken into sort of the core, the center of the Christian music industry, and became part of radio airplay in the 80s and 90s, for instance. You have this distinction between praise and worship music on the one hand, that for the most part, small church-based, mostly charismatic publishing companies are putting out, and then CCM on the other, contemporary Christian music, which is music for listening, that's getting radio airplay. And yes, of course, there's overlap, between the two. We can think of examples of, Amy Grant, El Shaddai, some of these Michael W. Smith songs that make it into churches. But there are two, in some ways, separate industries and separate networks that come together around for a variety of reasons. Again, another interview for that one, that come together around the year 2000. And from then on, you now have, within the contemporary Christian music industry, you have kind of two options for two streams. You used to have the kind of traditional contemporary Christian music artists who see themselves as, writing songs to sing solo or as a group, kind of for people's encouragement, for people to listen to. But then you have others who are worship leaders or worship artists who are writing or performing songs that everyone's meant to sing together, that are meant to be adopted by churches, that are intended for congregational singing. And as the result of the worship music being taken up into the heart of the Christian music industry, not shortly thereafter, you have what you might call a crisis of authenticity, where people start to wonder, have these people sold out? How can I trust this issue of trust, where these songs are coming from? And there are some fascinating accounts from people in the music industry. There was one particular record company I know that in, I think it was 2008 or 2009, that all of their worship artists, they made a top-down decision that you must be grounded in a local church, that they were getting flack because, you know, well, these artists are touring everywhere, but where's your heart for ministry? Where's your experience? Is this song coming out of a place of actual interaction with actual people in a local congregation? And so top down, some of these artists, no lie, got assigned to church, that some of these assignments worked better than others. But so you see this crisis of authenticity where in order to be a successful worship leader who is on the concert circuit, the people at that, you know, within the concert have to trust that the person's motives are wants to lead people in worship and, you know, not make a ton of money or not make a name for themselves. So they have to distance themselves from some of the trappings of popularity while obviously, you know, embracing others. And so the concert space is this fascinating place where, you know, you have someone with stage lights on them, you've got fog machines, you've got, you know, state of the art audio visual equipment being used, and you have the person on stage saying over and over and over again like a mantra, I am not here to perform for you. I am not here to perform for you. I'm not here. I'm not an artist. I'm a worship leader. So I started, after attending a lot of these concerts, I started to kind of put this together that, okay, in order for this person to be successful, they have to distance themselves. What are the mechanisms that they use to try to establish their authenticity as a worship leader? So I look at, over the course of this chapter, I look at some of these mantras that are used verbally, you know, kind of the disavowal of fame. And I look at the way that influences the songs themselves, that these disavowals of fame can be read, if you will, in the very song lyrics that the worship leaders are coming up with and singing, trying to displace the fame that comes from Christian celebrity culture from themselves onto God.
That's fascinating, Monique.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So similar to the concert is the conference, which is the subject of your next chapter. In many ways, the concert and the conference are using some of the same trappings, but you note that conferences serve a very different function in the faith of many different believers. What are some of those key differences for the conference congregation?
Yeah. So the conference and concert congregations, there's a lot of continuity between those, because oftentimes there are at conferences, you could consider them a string of many, you know, mini concerts, you know, in the morning and in the evening. But the main, the difference and the sort of the different analytical rubric that that people that grew out of my field research at these conferences, talking to people, listening to the discourse from the stage, is that attendees to conferences think of it as a pilgrimage experience. They think of it as something that they do, that they travel to a place, and granted, you know, it's different from a traditional pilgrimage in that, you know, some of the geographical place doesn't matter. It's more it's the experience that is the experience and the teaching that that comes with it that is the center of the pilgrimage. But this is a way that people conference pilgrims themselves talk about it. This is also the way that they are encouraged to frame it from the stage, you know, and one aspect of the experience that's at the center of the pilgrimage is the image and the imagination of heaven. Heaven is a dominant theme. People, look around you and try to imagine heaven. You'll see a screen, or you'll have worship leaders who, in between the songs, you know, talk about the mighty throng that gathers at the throne of God at the end of time, comprised of every tongue, tribe, and race of people. And you hear these same things being echoed from congregants. You know, I sent out a survey after one of these events, and just person after person were saying, you know, it was like a taste of heaven. This is what heaven's going to be like. And so conferences in particular, I think because they are, number one, you know, prolonged, this is more than just a 2 or 3 hour concert. This is many days of intense religious experience, and much of which the participatory element, I think one of the things that's crucial, you know, for our purposes here, is that the mode of participation for the most part is singing. You know, I counted up in these a couple of conferences that I went to, conferences for college students, kind of the 18 to 25 year old age range. I counted up, and if people are participating in each of the main sessions, they're singing somewhere between 4 and 6 hours a day. And so what they sing then was like a traditional pilgrimage. You know, pilgrims like to take home souvenirs, right, of their experience, things with them that they can use to recreate and in their local settings as well as to remember. The music becomes a token of that pilgrimage, where people take home these albums, and when they listen to them, they recall particular moments or things that they were praying, or things that they believe God revealed to them, and they embed them in different contexts for that reason. It was out of their pilgrim experience that these songs become transported to local contexts.
Well, speaking of local church, that is exactly where you go with your next chapter. So you have this extended case study of how one church in a denomination that tends to shy away from evangelical theology or maybe just contemporary worship music more broadly, how this church, St. Bartholomew's in Nashville, had pursued a unique approach of reappropriating and repackaging the industrial product or artifact of contemporary worship music. Tell us about what you observed in this congregation in Nashville and what it tells us about how particular congregations operate within this broader landscape of musical production.
Yeah. So the local church, and I thought it was appropriate also in the ordering, there are 5 case study chapters. The church is the third, is kind of at the heart of the book, and this church also, so another way that the church was the heart, this was my congregation in Nashville. This was my own congregation that I initially didn't set out to make a specific case study about it, because I, as I mentioned in the book's introduction, I mean, I was, have been, am on a journey, and my trajectory, you know, through the period that I was researching and writing was one of increasing distance, really, from the evangelical worship tradition. And so choosing an Episcopal church, which is, you know, part of mainline Protestant tradition, that was one kind of mode of, you know, distancing myself from the phenomenon, or so I thought that it was distancing myself. And then at this church, it considered itself, I'm not sure it would use this designation today, at the time that that I attended about a decade ago, it described itself as evangelical Episcopal. In some ways, it could be considered, you might put it in the post-evangelical, a lot of people who had come from Baptist, non-denominational, other kinds of backgrounds that were, whether for theological or political ideas were changing, or, you know, for very practical reasons, like I'm a Methodist and I married a Catholic. We need somewhere to worship together. This had become a home for kind of a motley group of mostly non-cradle Episcopalians. And it was only kind of as I worshiped and as I participated in the music ministry, I was a regular pianist, you know, singer in the choir at this church, that I realized there are some fascinating dynamics at work in this congregation, you know, that are, you know, yes, some of them are specific to a mainline Protestant church that's trying to reconcile its history of being a center for charismatic renewal, and then having all of these kind of non-charismatic evangelicals at it. So there are some distinct things about the church's history that I bring out, but then there are some general ideas and some general processes that I think are widely applicable to a variety of churches. Just how you navigate, how an individual church congregation navigates its own institutional history, as well as its network, its network or its denominational ties, while and how it uses music to do that. And that was one of the things that I found at this congregation, is that worship music, evangelical worship music, was used in some ways symbolically, as to say, you know, this is an important part of who we are. It's not all of who we are. And here are some other types of music that connect us to different networks. We sing Taizé, you know, we sing, you know, songs out of the 1982 Episcopal hymnal, you know, with big organ fanfare and everything else. And so I thought it was interesting how this music becomes a symbol for, you know, a symbol for certain values that the congregation holds, but that it's not seen as able to encapsulate all of them.
That's great. And then moving to the last two case studies, you've taken us from the concert to the conference, all the way down to the congregation, and now we go back out again to the praise marches and YouTube. So how is music functioning to form and shape community when worship takes the streets or the broadband networks?
Yeah. Well, when worship enters, so the first three spaces are, as you've just implied, these are where the people with similar beliefs, similar practices are coming together and solidifying those. In the last two cases, all of a sudden worship becomes something that is visible to others. You have people outside the community or at the margins of the community to consider. So with the praise march, the purpose of this praise march, as with many others, it has many purposes depending on who you talk to, but it is to represent, in some ways, represent the church as unified in one area to the surrounding society in order to, with an evangelistic purpose, you know, trying to bring people in, as well as a, again, depending on your theology here, for a lot of the charismatic members, a kind of a spiritual warfare component of taking worship out into the streets and thus, you know, testifying to the worldly principalities and powers, and reinforcing the dominance of you know, of God over these. So, but something unique that you run into with the with bringing worship to the streets, I put it right after the church chapter because in some ways it's multiple individual church congregations that are coming together and trying to struggle with, okay, how do we represent? We want to represent ourselves as unified. You know, we are the Christians of Toronto. but at the same time, we're coming from all these different denominations. In the case of this, in the case of this praise march, also coming from, you know, different ethno-linguistic groups. So markedly diverse. So how do we reconcile this unity, unity with diversity, diversity within unity? And one way, sort of unsurprisingly, that they do that is through through the music that they choose, and talking to the different people who are responsible for their church's musical choices here. You know, they would talk about being very careful with the balance. They say, we want something that represents our church. You know, so we did this number of songs in Korean or this number of songs in Ukrainian or whatever else, but we want something that is going to link us to the other churches that we're marching with. So that's why we did, you know, this Hill song, or, you know, this Chris Tomlin song, or whatever else. And so you see this, you see people, and then you also want, you know, some degree of reaching out to people outside a church setting. So people would interwork, you know, interesting, you know, Michael Jackson bass lines into the introduction of certain songs, or they would put in Amazing Grace or things that they felt would be widely known. So it's really that the outside, knowing that there are people outside the community looking in, that conditions the you know, the musical choices that are made during the parades and to some extent online spaces. So with online online worship, it of course depends on whether you're talking about live stream services, of which there are many, and you probably have fewer, you know, you have some curious people, but not as many people are going to tune into a live service as, say, you know, troll a YouTube music video. So you also have, you know, watching the comment streams on YouTube music, worship music videos is fascinating because you have this mixture of, I mean, it is this very public form of worship where you go from a couple of comments that are like, I'm raising my hands at the computer screen and, you know, this song makes me cry, or, you know, I was at, you know, the pilgrimage stories, right, where I was at the conference where this song was recorded and I remember what it was like to, you know, be among that throng of, you know, 20,000 voices or whatever else. So amidst those, you also have, you've got the trolls coming in saying your God is stupid, or, you know, saying whatever trolls say, and then people responding to them and, you know, and evangelizing. So it's just this, it's online provides this opportunity that, especially in North America, that we just don't have, of sort of open air, you know, worship, because of the way that, you know, that our communities and cities are designed. It's much more difficult to, you know, have regular gatherings where people who are interested what on earth is going on here can just, you know, kind of come up and enter a conversation. But I do see that happening online.
That's such a fascinating way of thinking about public space and the comment threads, which, oh man, are always a scary, wild, dangerous, fun, exhilarating place.
All of
on the World Wide
Absolutely.
Web. Absolutely. Well, Monique, I'm so glad that you could come and share with us about your book. And I'm sure that listeners have already gotten a sense that there's so much more in the case studies that is ready for them to explore, and if they go could get a copy of the book. And so I just encourage people to go and get that so they can dive even deeper into the wonderful research that you've done. But before we go, I wonder if you would just be willing to share with us a little bit about what you're working on the moment.
Yeah, sure. So a couple of things, and a couple of things that I would encourage listeners to check out as well. So I'm interested, this book is, you know, of course, we've talked a lot about evangelicals and evangelical, worship, but kind of congregational music more generally is something that my work has focused on. And I'm very interested in interdisciplinary and international approaches to congregational music making. And so to that end, one of the things I'm involved in is being one of the organizers of the Christian Congregational Music Conference. This conference meets biennially usually in Oxford. For obvious reasons, this year we chose to make this will be our first virtual conference, and it's taking place over 2 weeks. We have an asynchronous first week where we'll have a number of papers, and there are, you can, congregationalmusic.org, very easy to find. You can log into our conference page to see what kinds of papers are there. We have 8 themes, you know, congregational music making and well-being, global gospel, congregational music and COVID, among many others. And so we are again trying to encourage this international interdisciplinary perspective that includes both people of coming from faith perspectives, Christian or other religious perspectives, as well as those not coming from faith backgrounds or perspectives. I think a lot of times there has been this divide, at least in my experience, between conversations about, you know, a church music or congregational music taking place among Christians, among insiders, and then those conversations that are taking place among, you know, kind of quote unquote secular academic, you know, social sciences and humanities. And this conference tries to bring those conversations together in one place. And I'm always amazed by the kinds of work and the fruitful connections that can be made, you know, when you bring people together across those lines. So please check out congregationalmusic.org. Our conference is this summer. Very excited about it. We have an asynchronous week, as I mentioned, and then a synchronous week with, I think we've got 9 plenary talks. We've got some interactive music making sessions, groups from Latin America, from the UK, from other places who will be leading various kinds of congregational song. So that's one thing. Another thing that I've been working on is I am senior editor for the Congregational Music Studies series, which is a book series with Routledge Press. And we have, I should have looked up exactly how many books we now have in the series. I know there are 3 coming out right now. So I know that my number is going to be, if I tried to come up with one, would be a bit off, but our fourth edited volume that's part of the series is called Studying Congregational Music, Key Issues, Theories, and Methodologies. And that Studying Congregational Music, I co-edited that with 2 of my colleagues, and it is intended as an introductory, as a handbook for researchers. We outline 6 different methods for studying congregational music, from ethnography to liturgical history to music analysis to media studies. So a number of different approaches. And then we talk about key issues or lenses through which we can look at congregational music. So things like race, ethnicity, and gender, and diaspora, and some of these those lenses. So I'm particularly excited about that book. I'm planning to use it in one of my own graduate courses this fall, because, you know, introduction to research in congregational song. It's kind of the textbook for that. So those are a couple of upcoming things.
Well, those both sound like wonderful projects maybe we can have you and the editors on at some point to talk about that excellent new volume. Well, this has been a conversation with Monique Ingalls talking about her new book, Singing the Congregation, How Contemporary Worship Music Forms Evangelical Community, available now from Oxford University Press. Monique, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning into this episode of New Books in Christian Studies. You can go to our website at newbooksnetwork.com to find more great author interviews. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode, the most valuable thing that you could do is think of someone who might find the conversation that we've been having here today interesting and send them a link. It's the best way that you can support what we're doing here at the New Books Network. That's it for now, and I hope you have a great day.